So he picks the man up horizontally from his backpack and his waistband about 3 feet in the air and slams him down.
A witness to an arrest in Bethel alleges police brutality. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska fire crews head south.
Saturday morning, we had five Alaska Type 2 crews. They left for fires in California's Klamath National Forest.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
After months of compromise between the Anchorage Assembly and public employee unions, the city's voters may still end up deciding on a controversial labor law due to a mayoral veto. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan struck down the substitute for Anchorage Ordinance 37 this afternoon. AO 37, which the mayor championed, prohibited the municipality's unions from striking, capped pay raises, and put limits on collective bargaining. The law was panned by labor, and a campaign to overturn it collected 20,000 signatures to get their referendum on the ballot. The ordinance that was passed last week was an effort to avoid that outcome, and it got rid of some elements of AO 37 that labor found unpopular. But the compromise only passed 7-4, one vote short of being able to override a mayoral veto. The assembly has the option of meeting tomorrow night if they want to try securing the 8th necessary vote to reject the veto. If they cannot, AO 37 will remain law until the repeal question is put to voters in November. Mayor Sullivan, who is running for lieutenant governor, is expected to appear on the same ballot. Alaska seafood industry is getting caught in the middle of a power struggle between Russia and Western nations. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
Ever since Russia seized part of Ukraine this winter, sanctions against it have been stacking up. Now Russia's fighting back by banning food imports from the United States and a handful of other nations. Alaska shipped almost $9 million worth of pollock to Russia last year. Some of it went to fast food chains, including McDonald's. A significant chunk of it is used for making surimi, better known as fake crab. At least one shipment of surimi was on its way to Russia when the ban came out on Thursday. Undercurrent News reports that the fish could get diverted to South Korea or another eastern market. That's got some American fishing advocates fired up. A former U.S. congressman has started the Just Say Niet campaign, seeking a corresponding ban on Russian fish coming into the states. But it's slow going. As of Friday afternoon, his petition to the federal government had only gathered 18 signatures. In on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
A woman from Arizona who works as a professor doing seasonal research in the YK Delta says she witnessed an arrest of a citizen by a Bethel police officer, and she alleges police brutality. City leaders say they're investigating. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
Around 9:15 in the morning on Saturday, July 12th, Linda Green says she saw a police car pull up next to a man walking past AC store in downtown Bethel. Green says the officer and the man spoke briefly, then the officer jumped out of the car, grabbed the man's arm, and flipped him face down onto the pavement and tried to handcuff him.
So he picks the man up horizontally from his backpack and his waistband about 3 feet in the air and slams him down, puts his knee back on his back, again tries to twist those arms around, unable to do so. Three more times, he picks that man up and slams him down into the ground.
She says the large police officer then sprayed something into the smaller man's face. Then Green says another man in plain clothes and an unmarked car pulled up and helped the officer. Green says the event was shocking.
I was horrified, and I was standing there yelling, "Stop, stop!" Because it was just so horrific to see this kind of action taking place.
She took her complaint to Police Chief Andre Ishe, to Interim City Manager Greg Moyer, and to Mayor Joe Klaika. She filed a statement with the police department, told her story to KYUK, and published a letter to the editor in the Delta Discovery newspaper. Once Green's story got out around town, KYUK listeners emailed in to complain.
Anonymous emails coming in. The first one says, I read an article in the Delta Discovery this past week, and I was disgusted about what I read.
This email was read on KYUK's weekly talkline program.
It seems like they're getting worse and worse from what I hear and how they are doing their job. They are supposed to be protecting and serving instead of mishandling and manhandling some of our citizens.
Court documents and a police report about an incident that occurred at the same location on the same date and at the same approximate time tell a different story than Green's. A report says there was no call for police help, but that an officer by the name of Andrew Reed observed Wassily Gregory at 9:18 a.m. as clearly intoxicated near the AC. The report says that Gregory made verbal threats to Reed and challenged him to a fight, and that Reed was afraid he might be grabbing for a weapon. However, there was no mention of Gregory having a weapon in the report or in a court affidavit. The report notes that an off-duty trooper and a probation officer stopped to help Reed, and that Reed arrested Gregory. The report says Reed transported Gregory to the hospital, where he was medically cleared, and says that he didn't have any injury other than a cut to his face.
State of Alaska versus Wassily Gregory.
But audio from Gregory's court hearing on July 13th quotes a prosecutor and a trooper saying Gregory couldn't appear because of injuries.
Mr. Gregory is at YKHC. I think he suffered a broken
collarbone.
Collarbone, thank you. I believe that maybe the trooper can confirm that. I think that was Mr. Gregory.
Was that Wassily Gregory?
Yes, Your Honor. He's last I heard, he's being sedated. He wouldn't be available.
So he's at the YKHC with a broken clavicle?
Dislocated shoulder and possibly a broken bone. I'm not sure.
In the affidavit, Officer Reed says he, quote, kindly tried to assist Gregory into my cruiser for protective custody when he pulled away, end quote. 48-year-old Gregory finally appeared in court on July 14th. Gregory was originally charged with disorderly conduct, harassment, and resisting arrest. The charges of disorderly conduct and resisting arrest were dropped, but he pleaded guilty as part of a plea deal to harassment to offensive physical contact. Green filed her statement with the Bethel Police Department on the same day she witnessed the incident, 2 days before Gregory took the plea deal. Green points out in her letter that being intoxicated in public is not a crime in Alaska. Alaska law allows law enforcement officers to provide assistance to people who are intoxicated in public and appear a danger to themselves and others. KYUK was unable to reach Gregory. Officer Reed was contacted for this story but did not return phone calls or emails. Other officers involved declined to comment. Green says she came to KYUK because nobody from the city would get back to her.
At the very least, I thought at the very least that the people in authority would want to talk to me. And no one seems to want to talk to me. And that seems to add to a narrative about abuse of power in Bethel.
Bethel city officials eventually told Green that they were conducting an investigation. KYUK contacted Bethel City officials for this story. They say they will not comment about an ongoing investigation. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Federal investigators have concluded two Anchorage commercial pilots failed to maintain minimal clearance while circling the Dillingham Airport before they died in a 2013 crash. A National Transportation Safety Board report out today also faults the air traffic controller who issued ambiguous instructions and didn't notice the plane's descent to a dangerous altitude. The Ace Air Cargo plane crashed March 8, 2013, about 20 miles northeast of Dillingham in southwest Alaska. The crash killed 38-year-old pilot Jeff Day and 21-year-old co-pilot Neil Jensen. They had approached the Dillingham Airport and received permission to descend to 2,000 feet, but asked to enter a holding pattern while they checked on runway conditions. The minimum safe altitude southeast of the airport is 5,400 feet, and the plane crashed at just below 2,000 feet. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, elite runners from around the world meet and run in Anchorage.
I can't tell you the level of people we have here, just mental toughness, physical toughness, it's unbelievable.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
Alaska Village-based firefighting crews are heading south to fight blazes in the lower 48. Alaska Division of Forestry spokesman Sam Harrell is tracking the deployments, which began over the weekend with crews from the communities of Delta Junction, Caltag, Fort Yukon, Venati, Koyukuk, and Galena.
Saturday morning, we had five Alaska Type 2 crews. These are our emergency firefighting crews. They left for fires in California's Klamath National Forest.
Harrell says the next five village crews in the rotation are scheduled to fly south tomorrow.
Upper Tananaw, St. Michael, Mountain Village, Silowik No. 2, and Pilot Station. They're also headed for fires in Northern California.
Harrell says the 10 village crews are joining Alaska-based Smoke Jumper, Initial Attack, Hotshot, and other high-level firefighting crews already sent south in recent weeks, bringing the total number of Alaskans deployed outside to 514. He says firefighters are generally on two-week assignments, but can be hired to work additional rotations. Fort Wainwright officials have closed the Yukon training area east of Eielson Air Force Base to public use through August 23rd. Military training exercises will be ongoing there. Post officials say in a news release that the quarter million area training range is off limits to all. They say people who've had regular access through the area to get to private or leased property must use an alternate route. Training underway in the Yukon training area includes joint exercises with Army personnel as part of the latest red flag training round that began this week. Meanwhile, Stryker Brigade soldiers from Wainwright are conducting exercises in the Donnelly training area south of Fort Greeley. The Yukon River Chinook Salmon Run is nearly complete, according to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, it's the first time in roughly 8 years that escapement goals lined out in a treaty between Alaska and Canada have been met.
This year, managers up and down the Yukon River set restrictions on both commercial and subsistence harvest of king salmon. They were hoping to see up to 55,000 fish pass into Canada. Numbers recorded through the first week of August show that more than 60,000 king salmon have passed the sonar counter at Eagle. Fred Bew is the Yukon area in-season manager for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is not a good year, but with all the efforts by everybody, I think we're continuing to get fish on the spawning grounds, and hopefully that holds over till the production trend changes.
It's unclear why the king salmon population has been in decline for years. Bew says biologists do have a theory for this year's uptick in returning Chinook.
One indication is that five-year-old age class is fairly strong. In 2009, we had a pretty good escapement that year. So we're anticipating the six-year-olds to be fairly good next year. The females tend to be six-year-old fish, and so we're hoping that we'll get a little higher percentage of females in the return.
More females means more fish eggs, which could potentially mean more fish in the future. King salmon are just now arriving at their Canadian spawning grounds. Bew says the Department of Fish and Game is working with Canada's Department of Fisheries and Oceans on how best to manage them.
Roughly half of the Chinook salmon spawn in Canada, and so... You know, a lot of the information we get, we need to share. We both harvest on both sides of the border, and then also the escapement, what gets into the spawning grounds, the biology of the fish that we're seeing in the returns. And so we need, you know, the Alaska is only a portion of the story, and Canada is the other half, and so we need to combine our information.
Canadian managers have also imposed commercial and subsistence harvest restrictions on king salmon this year. Alaskan managers say the Chinook run past Eagle is more than 95% complete, so they've lifted restrictions in Alaska's portion of the Upper Yukon. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
On Saturday, the search for a missing fisherman around Willow Creek was called off. Jerry Warner of Missouri was last seen on August 3rd, walking upstream from an RV campground for a solo fishing trip. The Alaska State Troopers describe Warner as an experienced outdoorsman, but say that he did not have survival gear or a cell phone with him when he was last seen. The six-day search included troopers, Matsu Borough emergency responders, and volunteers from a number of search and rescue groups. Up to 40 people were searching for Warner at one point, using dogs, ATVs, boats, and a helicopter, but no sign of him has been found. Troopers say they will analyze and respond if any new clues to Warner's location are found. State troopers found the body of Nick Cook near Tuntutuliak Friday. They received a report from the tribal police officer from Tuntutuliak that a body had been located on the bank of the Kuskokwim River, just south of the Gallic River. Megan Peters is a spokesperson for the Alaska State Troopers.
Troopers were able to respond and collect the remains, and the remains have been sent to the state medical examiner's office for positive identification. At this time, we do believe that the remains belong to a man that was the subject of a search and rescue, which began on October 25th of last year.
The family confirmed the body found is the body of Bethel man Nick Cook. Because of protocol, the remains were sent to the state medical examiner's office for positive identification. No foul play is suspected. Nick Cook and Jim Lee Nipaka were last heard from on October 22nd. They were headed to Tuntutuliak for a funeral and never made it. Freezing weather halted the search in November. Nipaka is still missing. Cook is the brother of Bethel Native Corporation president and Alaska Federation of Natives co-chair Anna Hoffman. The family of Nick Cook says they are preparing for a burial service in Bethel later this week.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Where can you see more than 1,000 entertainers, from Alaska Native dancers to dinosaurs? The Alaska State Fair. This year, everyone attending the fair can enjoy music free with fair admission, like Riders in the Sky, Young Dubliners, Redhead Express, Savannah Jack, Home Free, and Kentucky Lineman. Learn more at thealaskastatefair.org. Music, fair food, and good time fun. It's what the Alaska State Fair is all about. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
August is a popular time for hitting the trails around Anchorage, but for an elite group of ultra runners, last week was all about taking their sport indoors. Nearly 50 people from all over the world plodded away in the Alaska Dome, trying to log as many miles as they could in 6 days. KSKA's Monica Goki has more.
It was almost 11 at night on a Wednesday in the Alaska Dome last week, and Willow, Alaska resident Dave Johnston had been running for nearly 3 days. Some of that time was spent hunched over the toilet, puking. Multi-day ultra running is extremely hard on athletes.
Stomach's finally starting to feel better, and so now let's just see if we can run.
You're getting in a groove. Now, you've done a lot outdoors. What made you sign up for a six-day event?
Joe, pretty much.
Johnston's talking about Joe Feegis. He's the one who came up with his event.
Sent an email and stuff. I told him yesterday when I was running in the bathroom puking all day, I told him, thanks so much. And he said he was sorry because he knew how bad I felt. That was funny.
But you straightened up a bit?
So far right now, yeah. The last 12 hours has been the first time I've felt good the whole race, so.
Johnston recovered from his rough start. By Friday, Johnston was in second place, trailing the leader by less than 20 miles.
Whew, he's fast.
And the competition was stiff. A lot of the most prominent ultra runners from throughout the world were at the Alaska Dome last week. The six-day ultra event was called 6 Days in the Dome, and it's just like it sounds. Runners logged as many miles as they could in 6 days. It sounds crazy, and it kind of is.
This is what we've chosen to do with our vacation time and with our extra dollars.
That was Ed Ettinghausen of Southern California. He's dressed like a jester, and he brought 6 different jester outfits to the race, one for each day. His wife and daughter are sleeping at one end of the track while he puts one foot in front of the other, smiling, bells bouncing atop his jester hat. There's another guy here from Brazil who ran 142 miles on the first day of the race. You can tell that people were equally impressed slash appalled by his feat. But by Wednesday night, he was out of the race, sleeping on a high jump mat to recover. One of the race organizers, Zane Holscher of North Carolina, says this motley crew of nearly 50 is actually one of the most elite packs of ultrarunners worldwide.
To do this on this track, day after day, and when you sleep, you get so tight and then they had to come out and run again. I can't tell you the level of people we have here, just mental toughness, physical toughness, it's unbelievable.
So how did they end up in Alaska?
Turns out there's only a couple facilities like this in all North America with a 400 meter track indoors. Most of them are 200 meter or 300 meter tracks.
Race organizers wanted an indoor, temperature-controlled, element-free track that would allow the runners to simply run.
And this turned out perfect because everyone in Alaska wants to be outside in the summer instead of inside, and we want to be inside. So kind of a supply and demand, we were able to work out something great with the Dome, and I cannot say enough about how great this facility is.
The Dome also doubled as a hotel for the race. At one end of the track, runners set up camp. Sweaty clothes were draped over hurdles to dry, and athletes were curled up on high jump mattresses that doubled as beds. And the event was even serving its own food, three meals a day.
Eggs, bacon, Pop-Tarts, pancakes, Pop-Tarts, breakfast burritos, Pop-Tarts, oatmeal, Pop-Tarts, eggs, bacon, Pop-Tarts. Pop-Tarts are the standard fare here.
Everything is runner food. After a couple of days, if it can't get away and or kill you, it's food.
And we have a sushi lunch on Thursday.
After six sleepless days and nights, the race finished on Sunday morning. Race organizer Joe Fegis of Atlanta, Georgia, took first, having logged 580 miles. For the women, Liz Bauer logged 425 miles for the win, and sixth place overall. No runners broke the 600-mile goal the cash prize was contingent on. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Goki.
Former State Representative Bill Stoltz is eyeing a new state Senate seat. The District F seat will include the eastern Anchorage suburbs of Peters Creek and Chugiak, as well as the greater Palmer area and outlying communities to the north. But current Palmer Mayor Delina Johnson has thrown her hat into the ring, and now the two Republican candidates will face off in the upcoming August 19th primary. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Republican candidates for the District F Senate primary are similar on the surface. Both Bill Stoltz and Delina Johnson grew up in small-town Alaska, and both are adamantly opposed to Proposition 1. There, the similarity ends. Stoltz and Johnson have been debating in recent weeks, bringing a local slant to the big issues. One of the biggest, affordable energy. Bill Stoltz says he's worked hard to keep Susitna-Watonna Dam funding in the state budget.
I thought that was an important step, not to abandon a project of which so much had been invested in, and it has such potential for Alaska. We have a goal of 50% renewable resources by 2020. No other project other than hydro gets you there.
53-year-old Stoltz, with a dozen years in the legislature behind him, co-chaired the House Finance Committee and has been a member of that body since 2003. 50-year-old Johnson, a two-time mayor of Palmer, owns Ethos LLC, a property development company, and has made reduced government spending one of the tenets of her campaign. She says her priorities are costs, and costs will determine the big projects slated for the district.
Certainly, there's some that have more benefit to residents, but I would say we have to prioritize based on what we can afford. And we can afford it, I say, let's build as much as we possibly can.
But Stoltz says it's a legislator's job to prioritize.
That's one of the things we did this last session is we prioritized that we would keep Susitna on track so at least we could get to the next step and determine its viability. That was leadership and prioritization.
Johnson says she's flushed wasteful spending from Palmer's budget and that she'll bring a fiscally conservative attitude to the legislature. The two candidates had this lively exchange when asked about the cost of the renovation of the state building in downtown Anchorage.
I have tried to throw as many hurdles in the way of that as possible, like everything from voting against the furniture consulting contract.
Well, I guess this is new information to me because my understanding is that you allowed that to go forward with a no-bid contract.
Johnson has raised 5 children, all of them educated at home or in Mat-Su Borough schools. She says her experience will help her to bring a common-sense, practical approach to education funding.
I know a little bit about school choice because I've homeschooled my children. I've also had my children in charter school. My youngest son is now a senior at Palmer High School, so I've had quite a gamut of educational experience. So I'm all for making things work first and foremost for the children and not to look at it from a 10,000-foot bureaucratic view.
Stoltz can't say he has kids in local schools, but says he's in favor of educational choice, whether that means charter schools, homeschools, or vocational training.
I suspect it's not unusual for a parent to be involved in their school with their kids, but I'd say, look at my record. I have been involved with just about every school in the Valley, and if you talk to teachers and students there, they know who Bill Stoltz is. They know I'm engaged in their schools, not because I'm cared about my kids, but I care about your kids.
Possibly one of the more contentious issues dividing the candidates, Cook Inlet fisheries. Stoltz backs the Mat-Su Borough's initiative aimed at bringing more sport fish to the Northern District River drainages. He says he's shocked that Johnson has employed a commercial fisheries lobbyist on her campaign staff. But Johnson counters,
we absolutely have to not target industries and decide we're going to put them out of business. So it doesn't matter if it's sport fishing or commercial fishing, somebody's making their money that way. Instead of dividing the interests, we have to work together to make this fish resource sustainable.
Both candidates say they work hard to serve local interests. Delana Johnson.
The government closest to the people governs best. And local government, knowing what people need, that's what the kind of experience that I bring.
Stoltz says he's got a history of working for communities, whether they are inside his district or not.
Not caring about the boundaries, but looking how we can make the Valley and Chugiak an even better place, regardless of these arbitrary political lines, which I've ignored in the past and I will in the future.
Winning the primary may come down to determining who is bound to have the biggest legislative clout, since so many big projects in the Valley depend on legislative support. According to the APOC, at end of the last reporting period, Stoltz had about $37,000 remaining in his campaign chest, while Johnson had about $8,300. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dacia Eaton in Bethel, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Monica Goki in Anchorage, and Ellen Lockyer in Palmer. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Pat Yak is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. You may be eligible for VA health care benefits, including reimbursement for your care at 26 tribal health care facilities and their 180-plus outlying clinics manned by providers and community health aides throughout the state of Alaska. Apply online at 1010ez.med.va.gov. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message sponsored by the VA. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.